development, and we're going to go a little bit out of order. I got a couple of bills, but a lot of people signed up, and so I don't want to have to deal with that at the moment, and at the expense of people, others. So I'm going to take those that I know we can deal with, and we'll go from there. And if we get time, we'll get to them. So we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2439 and ask Andrew Morrow and Stephen Hull to come forward, please. And it looks like Representative McPherson is part of this group, too.
I am, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. Really, my role here is to introduce the subject and these great experts who can tell you more than you probably ever wanted to know on this subject.
Well, we want to hear what we need to know, but not more than we need to know. All right?
We'll try to keep it to that. I'm going to orient it very briefly. The subject of this bill is staggered boards of directors, which is means that the board of directors don't have terms that all expire at the same time. Instead, they overlap. And implementing a staggered board of directors is a standard technique for a public corporation. That is, when it's publicly traded on, has dispersed ownership, in avoiding a hostile takeover, because not all the members of the board of directors have a term that expires at once. So if somebody who's trying to take over control of that corporation in a hostile manner can't use a solicitation for the votes for board members to do that at one time. It stretches the process out.
Mm-hmm.
Through an inadvertent change, well, it was an intentional change, but inadvertently altered the law in Oregon on this subject, doubt has been cast onto the validity of staggered boards of directors that are already in place for corporations who have that staggered board authorized in their bylaws. And when we passed a bill changing the corporate law in a number of respects last session, we changed to a provision that requires the articles of incorporation to authorize the staggered board, and that causes a problem for corporations that already have a board of directors that's staggered, relying on a bylaw provision only. So the easiest fix is to amend the corporate statute to restore the provision that allows authorization of a staggered board in the bylaws. That's my introduction. I've got two experts here who know far more about this than I do, and they are available to make a presentation or to answer questions, whatever you like.
Okay. Well, give us the synopsis of that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Morrow. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland and here representing the Oregon State Bar Business Law Section and speaking in support of the bill. Just to expand a little bit on Representative McPherson's comments, the bill that was passed in 2003 was a bill brought to you by the Bar Business Law Section. Part of the reason for it was to conform some of the provisions in Oregon corporate law to the Model Business Corporation Act, which is an American Bar Association model bill adopted in a number of states and is the basis for a lot of the Oregon statute. What wasn't noted at the time was this change with respect to staggered boards in bylaws. The Model Act really only references articles of incorporation by conforming to that, and there were several respects in which the section was changed to conform to that. The bylaw provision was eliminated and was inadvertent. So the bill is intended to bring that back to where the law was in that respect and to protect the interests of the corporations who had that bylaw provision when this became effective in January 2004 and continue to make their bylaws effective throughout. And I'll stop there and answer questions.
Okay. So, I mean, as I read this and I've seen your testimony, you know, this is a permissive for the corporation to do, to have this authority to do it either in the articles of incorporation, which they have now, or the bylaws. And it doesn't create a mandate on any corporation to do that in any way. Any questions? Senator Atkinson.
Make this really simple, because I'm trying to understand. Why do we need a law, a bill? Why do we need a bill to do this?
Because, Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, because the provision otherwise would not allow a corporation to have a staggered board of directors, there are several public companies in the state who have done this through their bylaws, and the purpose of the bill is to protect those provisions which were effective up until January 1, 2004. The 2003 legislation inadvertently changed that, brought those provisions into question. This is to take that, put that back in the same place for those corporations.
Thank you. Any other questions? Now you can proceed, or we can move the bill.
If you're willing to move, I don't think you need me to repeat what Andy said.
Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2439. Open a work session on House Bill 2439.
Yes, sir.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2439 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2439 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Everybody, okay, Senator Starr will carry. Okay, now we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2578. And I just had it before me. Pat Levitt and Hal Scoggins, come forward, please. And before we begin discussion of this, I want to note a potential conflict of interest because my company does work for credit unions, including a couple in Oregon. With that, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt, representing the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Here with me today is our attorney, Hal Scoggins. He represents several credit unions in Oregon. House Bill 2578 is a combination of many discussions with our state and federally chartered credit unions in Oregon. How can we improve the Oregon Credit Union Act to help them serve their members better? It's a technical amendments bill. It passed the House 60-0. It has several provisions in it that relate to providing services to members throughout Oregon, and I'll let Hal speak to a couple of those issues.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Witt in Portland. We represent the Credit Union Association of Oregon, as well as a number of credit unions throughout Oregon and Washington. And I will try to be mercifully brief today. I know your time is precious. This bill contains a number of provisions that are designed to really clarify issues in the Oregon Credit Union Act and make it easier for Oregon credit unions to do what they do, which is to serve members, citizens of the state of Oregon. There are a couple of provisions that really illustrate what this bill is all about. The very first one that's listed in my testimony is the one on mobile facilities, and that's in Section 1 of the bill. And really what this does is just take authority that was already in the Act implicitly for credit unions to establish mobile facilities that's sort of like a mobile ATM machine, and sets forth the rules for those facilities that were already contained in the Bank Act, and this just really brings it over to the Credit Union Act and makes it equivalent. Same thing with the records provisions, the confidentiality provisions in Sections 2 and 3 of the bill. Right now, credit unions are governed by the confidentiality provisions that are in the Oregon Bank Act, and a lot of times credit unions don't necessarily think to look there to figure out exactly what the rules are and how they work as far as the Department of Consumer and Business Services goes, because credit union rules are generally found in the Credit Union Act. So what we've done is simply take those rules from the Bank Act, move them over to the Credit Union Act, and modify some of the language to account for the differences between credit unions and banks, the fact that credit unions have members, not shareholders. And then the last issue that I would talk about that really illustrates what the bill is all about is the issue on reserves. And Sections 10 and 11 of this bill change some provisions in the Credit Union Act that relate to how the credit unions kind of do their accounting and reporting to the Department of Consumer and Business Services with respect to reserves that they're required to maintain. The existing provisions talk about doing reporting and calculations based on some language in the National Credit Union Administration regulations that language is no longer there. And then it sets up rules and reports that credit unions have to do that are different from what they have to do under the federal laws. So right now, Oregon State Chartered Credit Unions have to provide two sets of reports and two sets of calculations for maintaining reserves, one under the federal rules and one under the state rules. This change allows credit unions to really just follow one set of reporting and maintenance requirements, and it gives the Department of Consumer and Business Services the flexibility to implement rules if at any time it determines that the federal requirements are inadequate to protect Oregon credit unions, then DCBS can step in and implement Oregon-specific rules if it needs to. So this really just simplifies things for the accounting and reporting requirements that credit unions are subject to. With that, I will be quiet and be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Questions for Mr. Scoggins on those provisions. Okay.
Ms. Levitt, thank you for your time.
Do you have anything else? Okay. And no one else is set to testify. Would anybody else like to testify on House Bill 2578? No? All right, we'll close public hearing on House Bill 2578. Open a work session on House Bill 2578.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2578 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2578 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Door. Senator Montes Anderson, do you want to carry that bill?
Sure.
Okay. We're going to move now ahead to opening a public hearing on House Bill 2637A. And ask John McCulley from the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals here, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, testifying in favor of House Bill 2637. This is a fairly simple bill. It does basically three things. The first thing it does is allows or limits the people who could access the bond that every mortgage banker and mortgage broker must have, limits the access to that bond to a consumer who signs the loan documents. There was a Supreme Court, Oregon Supreme Court case in June of 2004 that broadened the definition of who could access that bond to include people who weren't a direct party to the loan process. And so the original intent when the bill was first enacted in 1993 that established mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers licensing in the state was that that bond be there to protect the consumer. The bill 2637 returns to the original intent of the legislation in 1993. The second provision of the bill relates to continuing education that every loan originator is required to have. When the language was passed in 2001, every loan originator is to get 20 hours of continuing education every 2 years. One thing we overlooked in that process was that if you neglect to get those 20 hours, it's a felony. That seemed a bit harsh for not getting continuing education. So,
that would be quite an education.
That is an education. So House Bill 2637 allows it to be treated as a civil penalty, and we think that's enough of an enforcement tool. The third part of the bill strengthens the requirements when loan originators take a test to become a loan originator. This was part, again, of the 2001 legislation. Every loan originator who is new to this profession must pass an examination. We have discovered that in many circumstances there has been cheating on the examinations, where people from the same office will gather together around the computer and take the test online together. One person will take the test for everybody in the office. All sorts of creative ways of getting around the testing requirement. This bill strengthens that part of the requirement by saying that the test must be taken in a secure location and must be given by someone who has experience in professional test administration. We worked out amendments with the Department of Consumer and Business Services on the House side, added an amendment here that gives them a little more flexibility and clarified what we were intending. And the bill is ready to move forward with your approval.
Thank you, Mr. McCulley. Questions for Mr. McCulley? Well, I think it's pretty straightforward. Appreciate the work that was done on the House side on this. Yeah, we certainly don't want to, fill our prisons up with people who forgot to, get continuing education, because if we applied that to every profession, we would have to build a lot of prisons. Okay. I think we can close the public hearing on House Bill 2637 and open a work session on House Bill 2637. Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 2637 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr's moved House Bill 2637 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Note that we're all here except for Senator Deckard, who is excused, and so moved, and I will carry that one. Let's go down our list here. Okay, we're going to open up a House bill, a public hearing on House Bill 2719A, Sean Miller. And Chip Shield. Representative Chip Shield. Excuse me. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate you moving me up a notch. I've got to take my wife to the doctor shortly, and I think that's a pretty big priority for me today. And so I thank you for moving this bill. House Bill 2719A is good for business. It is particularly good for small, owner-operated, and family-owned businesses in which one or two people handle every aspect of the business's daily operations. This bill will extend the window for renewal and non-renewal of commercial liability policies, also known as general liability policies, from the 30 days that it is now to 45 days. Today, if an insurance company chooses not to renew your liability policy at the anniversary date, or if it renews the terms less favorable, you've got 30 days notice before coverage expires. This moves it to 45 and gives small businesses just a little bit more breathing room. And my legislative assistant, Marshall Jevening, and I surveyed 20 states west of the Mississippi, and we found that only Utah and Oregon had a notification window of under 45 days. And I believe that 45 days is a good step for Oregon business to give them just a little more time to find a new carrier if they need to, or to deal with any changes in their coverage. I'm pleased to say that representatives of the insurance industry have been very helpful in that process, as well as the Oregon Grocers Association. Sean Miller is here to talk about that, and I really do appreciate his support on this bill. It passed unanimously out of the House Committee on Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs, and passed unanimously on the House floor. So thank you for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Well, let's go ahead and hear from Mr. Miller here first.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller representing the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, here today in support of House Bill 2719. Just want to state for the record, Mr. Chair, appreciate Representative Shields working with the industry as well as the business groups and getting their support. I think it does, when looking at the other states surrounding Oregon, we did agree with Representative Shields that extending that time period is good for business and that we would support that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Well, we're moving the requirement notice from 30 days to 45 days. No questions. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2719A and open work session on House Bill 2719A. Senator Starr.
Move 2719A to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2719A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Sorry. Senator Atkinson, you haven't had a bill today. Would you like to?
I'd be delighted, Mr. Chair, to carry the weight of Sean Miller.
Thank you very much. Okay. How should I handle this? I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2604A. Got a lot of people signed up, so I will ask you not to be talkative, because we're going to move on otherwise to get to Senate Bill 671. So with that, who is in the audience to kick us off? Jana, is that you? Jana Jarvis? And I don't know if some of the individuals here that are signed up are with you, but you might ask them to come forward at the same time. Okay, Matt and Cynthia are the other ones signed up. So please, if you would come forward.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jana Jarvis. I represent the Oregon Association of Realtors, which are 15,000-plus members strong in every community in this state. We bring House Bill 2604 to you today, which we have worked on very hard on the House side. We had some differences with the commissioner and with the unions over there. We had two work group sessions. The bill, they came to a consensus. The bill passed out unanimously and passed the floor of the House unanimously, and so I had anticipated not taking very much of your time today. But because it looks like there are folks signed up in opposition, I think we need to go in and do a little explaining about House Bill 2604. And so for that reason, I've brought along Matt Farmer, who's general counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors, to kind of explain the purpose behind the bill and some of the specifics with that. And with that, I'll turn that over to Matt.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Farmer.
Thank you, Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, Matt Farmer, General Counsel, Oregon Association of Realtors. House Bill 2604 is the most recent of a series of legislation proposals by the Oregon Association of Realtors intended to increase professionalism and to bring real estate practices up to speed, real estate regulation up to speed with modern real estate practices. Oregon, as you may know, is a leader in real estate regulation and has responded to changes in the industry. The industry has changed more in the last few years than it has since World War II. And the big changes that have come, sellers' disclosure. Sellers must now disclose what they know about property. Disclosure of agency relationships. The statutory defining of the duties of real estate licensees, and then finally and most recently going to an all-broker single license industry, which is pretty much unique in the country. Rather than have brokers and salespeople, everyone is educated at the level of a broker now, thanks to the legislature. What 2604 is intended to do is to correct some problems that have sprung up as a result of regulations being developed over a period of 80 or 90 years to deal with a sales business that are now being applied to a professional service business where the people in that business are licensed as professionals. Because of the sales history of the real estate profession, regulation has tended to be that of regulating business practices. I think reasonably so, that you had a not well educated sales staff that was interacting with unrepresented consumers in very large purposes. Quite reasonably, the state said, well, we need to regulate the individual business practices of these people. The problem now is that ever since 1993, most buyers in the market are now represented, have their own agent, and that's thanks to the legislature and the advent of our licensing moving forward. What that does is shift, we think, the focus from regulation of business practices to the proper regulation of professional licensing, and that's what this bill is mostly intended to do. There are some other provisions that deal with licensing issues, trust accounting, and so on, but those really aren't controversial. The thrust of what is going on here is that right now in real estate there are 33 different grounds for discipline of real estate licensees. To put that in perspective, tax consultants, you know, an equally important, I think, civil function, there are 8 grounds. Nurses, there are 11. Construction contractors, 11, and a very closely related allied business of appraisers, 13. The reason there are 33 different ways as the grounds for discipline is that these have built up to regulate specific practices. What we're trying to do here is consolidate this to 13 now, having negotiated with the real estate agency and arrived at what we think are reasonable. And the reason that we want to do this, I think you'll hear some talk about lowering the bar or, you know, whatever political phrase is going to be popular. The reason that we're doing this is that having these multiple overlapping grounds for discipline is creating confusion in the industry, and this confusion then spills over into business practices. Basically, because licensees cannot be sure of the standard they're being held to, they try to protect themselves from everything. So right now in this state, to buy a house, you have a standard 7-page real estate agreement of fine print, 7 pages long. To that, The seller's agent will often add 6 or 7 more pages of disclosures, disclaimers, warranties, anything they can think of, because they can't predict down the road where somebody might claim they missed something. Then the buyer's agent will respond with another 5 or 6 pages. We now see real estate transactions over a residential house that run 20 pages of legalese. That's not efficient, and we don't think that's right. We also see so serious a problem that recently some lawyers that interact with the real estate agency in discipline cases actually proposed that the real estate agency support legislation that would not allow their own findings of facts, conclusions, and orders to be admitted into civil court. We're seeing real serious problems now where our members are so averse, risk averse, because they can't predict the outcome of these licensing decisions, that they will settle tort claims without any proof at all that they've caused any harm. And that what that does is then drive a vicious circle of complaints, costs, and so on. So what we want to do is propose a clear standard of professional conduct, 13 ways. It is our opinion, and nobody has to date ever said anything that would lead us to believe that this is not true. There is no conduct today that could be disciplined under the real estate regulations that cannot be disciplined under this bill. Our intent is to streamline and modernize. And the biggest thing, I think, here is making this shift to professional licensing. You know, all professionals make mistakes. And when they do, they are generally, if they cause damage, held liable for that. We don't disagree with that. Professional licensing, on the other hand, is more about setting a standard for people to practice this profession. And so, for instance, if the contractor uses the wrong techniques and the roof leaks, the contractor may be liable to fix the roof, but nobody takes away their contractor's license unless they can show something more in the way of this person not just made a mistake, but actually shouldn't be in this business. That's what we support, is getting a standard that says we want honest, trustworthy, diligent people in this profession. And we want then the freedom to set reasonable business practices without fear that somebody's later going to second guess what happened. You regulate physicians, but you don't tell them how to operate. You regulate lawyers, but you don't tell them what cases to plead. When they harm their clients, then that's an issue, and we agree with that. We think the biggest problem here is that for too long the real estate agency has depended on one or two very vague provisions of existing law. What we want to do, for instance, if somebody breaches a duty of care to their client, for instance, did not review some document with them, rather than some general idea of nebulous negligence, we think that it should be, since we now have the duties of real estate licensees in law, we think they should say, you violated this statute. Violation of a statute is grounds for discipline, and then the industry will begin to learn what the standard of care is. As it is right now, I think Cynthia could vouch for this, people are so uncertain that it is creating great dysfunction in the industry, and that is the purpose of 2604, trying to straighten that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farmer. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Cynthia Balzola. I am the 2005 president of the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I'm here today just to talk about the process that we use to arrive at our legislative policies and how they're passed, just so you have background on that. Each year, in the years between the legislative session, the Oregon Association of Realtors holds a legislative conference for realtors from throughout the state to come forward and bring issues and discuss issues that are of importance to us. From that conference, the issues of key importance are identified and forwarded to our governmental affairs key objective group, where they review the issues that have been brought forward and develop the legislative policies that we'll bring forward for the next next session. Those policies are then forwarded to the Executive Committee of the Oregon Association of Realtors, where they are reviewed, and then they are either sent back for recommendations or moved forward to the Board of Directors, where they are presented again and ultimately are approved by our Board of Directors. So that's the process that we use, and the issues with license law and the sanctioning and so forth have been a concern to realtors for a number of years. And what's being sought here is consistency, and we don't see it as lowering the bar for the industry or harming the public in any way. It really is. House Bill 2604 is essentially good for the public, it's good for the consumer, and it's good for the industry. And our goal is to continue to raise the bar.
Thank you. Questions of these panels? Okay, I want you to stand down. I'll move this and kind of get down to the nitty-gritty, because I think we know what the nitty-gritty is, so I want to get to that. We'll kind of do this like the debate. We start with the affirmative, and we'll end with the affirmative. So I'm asking the agency to come forward now before I ask others to come forward. And I have Mr. Oz, Becky Osborne and Christine Shute. And Mr. DeMarco, if you want to, this will be the one time that we'll like to do the agency stuff at once. And what I would ask you to do, folks, is that, you know, we've got a bill that has come out unanimously out of the House of Representatives. I think we have a narrow set of issues here, and I'd like to talk about those narrow sets of issues, not where everybody has agreement. Because I think members have read the bill and understand that. So, but I'd like to find out where it is that we now have an issue. So, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian DeMarco. I'm the Manager for Land Development and Policy Coordination for the Oregon Real Estate Agency. You've heard or will hear testimony that this bill is in conflict. There are competing legal theories. There's a lot of he said, she said. There's going to be who knew what and when did they know it. That doesn't matter. What matters is the bill before you. The process was flawed. The substance of the bill is flawed. I'll briefly address the flawed process. Ms. Osborne will address the flawed substance. The fact is, this agency did not know the substance or the details of this bill until it was dropped on the House floor in February. Why is that? For example, with House Bill 2096, it's our legislative concept housekeeping bill. I worked closely with OAR since August, trading drafts, communications with OAR. Not once during this time did OAR talk about this proposed legislative concept for 2604. Not once did they talk about it generally or in detail. Since May of last year, the agency worked closely with OAR on legislative concepts that came out of an agency budget note the previous session. Not once during this process was their proposed LC mentioned, either generally or in detail. Finally, the fact is, no other stakeholders outside OAR, property managers, licensees not affiliated with PMAR, even knew of this bill, let alone the detail that is involved or the ramifications of the bill itself. The process was flawed. The bill's implications were not adequately studied by all stakeholders in a timely manner. Ms. Osborne will now address the substance. We respectfully request that you not pass the bill out of committee, and alternatively, we respectfully request consideration and passage of the Dash Amendment to mitigate the more serious consequences of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeMarco. Before we go on, Senator Starr is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DeMarco, was there not a legislative hearing, public hearing, work session, work group on the House side related to this
bill?
That
is correct.
Were you not involved in that?
I was involved peripherally. Ms. Osborne can speak to that directly.
And so I'm just saying that you said that this, I mean, you talked about another bill that there was a work group on. Well, that's fine and good. That's not what this bill is about.
Correct.
But there was a work group on the House side. My understanding was there was a compromise reached. and that your agency stamped off on that compromise, and that there was testimony from your agency before the House committee that, that you were not, you didn't necessarily love the bill, but that it was compromised and you met, there's a middle ground, and the bill went forward. My understanding is it came out of committee unanimously, passed the House floor unanimously, with the agency basically saying we didn't get everything we wanted, but we're not going to stand in the way of this bill. And now you're coming to the Senate, and saying hold out, time out, there's a flawed process. This is a legislative process. Every legislative process has flaws. You can say that about any bill that passes out of this building.
I understand, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The point I was trying to make is that until the bill dropped in February, nobody knew anything. And then in February, everything was basically rushed through. Ms. Osborne will take the matter here because she was involved in those that process after the bill was dropped.
Ms. Osborne.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Becky Osborne. I'm the regulation manager at the Oregon Real Estate Agency. And to address Senator Starr's questions, yes, I was involved in those work groups I attended with our commissioner. And we did have many, many points of progress and compromise, reached points at which we were able to agree, restructured language, and made great movement, I think. But throughout the process, there were a couple of points where we were clear within the work group and submitted testimony that we could not compromise on a particular change within Section 3, specifically the change from a standard of negligence to gross negligence. And I believe our objections were noted in writing, and our commissioner made it very clear to Representative Kitts, who did an excellent job of bringing both sides together in great strides. I mean, it was noteworthy that there was so much accomplished in such a short amount of time as we worked closely with our AG to see what was covered, what wasn't, and worked through the bill. So I do want to acknowledge on the record that it was a remarkable achievement, but we did have one or two points where we were not able to concur.
Mr. Tanners. Senator Starr, then Senator Deckard.
In testimony in front of the House committee, did the agency support, oppose, or were you neutral on the bill?
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, the original hearing on the bill, we were opposing the bill. Two work group sessions occurred. The next convening was a work session. And at that time, as the bill was introduced, the committee administrator noted that from the work group, our objection to that particular section and the gross negligence change, that remained as after the work group. And there was a work session only. There was a question concerning the language that had been omitted in the construction by legislative council. That question came up, whether or not the agency was okay with the addition of that language back for the agency. I addressed that it was. The question came up from Representative Schaffler, whether AFSCME conferred with that change. Those were both provisions that were amended within Section 5. At the table, I agreed that we were okay with that, as we understood AFSCME was as well. But that in no way addressed the Section 3 concern that remains. And it's that I addressed in my written testimony today and would like to speak to briefly when you would like me to.
Okay. Let's, Senator Decker, I have a few questions and we'll proceed. Senator Decker.
No, mine was only that absent the process, I'm interested in what your objections are in Section 3. And I think she's getting at that.
Yeah, okay. And we will. So, Senator Atkinson, do you have a question?
Let them go through their testimony first.
Go ahead and proceed.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here today. I have submitted written testimony that enumerates where we have made those agreements section by section and what points remain about which we have objection. And I provided my written testimony today specific to where we are diverging, and I believe you have that before you.
Excuse me, Ms. Osborne. This one? Do you have it? Not there, this one.
That's correct.
Okay.
And that's dated
April 22nd.
I believe that's April 26th.
22nd. We don't have that.
Okay. I'm sorry. Thank you. The written testimony that you have is dated April 22nd, and that goes section by section. I have oral testimony copies that goes through.
Yeah.
Okay. We will provide that to you, but I can hit the points I want to make rather quickly in the interest of time. So thank you. Could I turn your attention, please, to Section 3? And this is the area specific to which the board is unable to compromise. Subsection 12 changes the standard of discipline from negligence to gross.
What pages are we on now?
Page 6 or page 7, line 2.
Thank you. That's right. That's our primary concern and has been. Ms. Shute is here with the Attorney General's office, and she will describe the legal position of that change. But there are two other considerations that I would like to point to very briefly. First, the removal of the negligence provision will cause a change in many of the cases that we compromise through the settlement process. As you can imagine, someone is much more inclined to accept a charge of negligence to resolve a real estate violation than to be referred to in other language such as incompetence or untrustworthiness. And very frequently, real estate licensees, when a violation is investigated and brought to their attention and we're in the settlement process, are pleased to be portrayed in final form of order in a negligence fashion. This change could cause us to take much more time in the settlement process if we're able to reach a settlement at all, possibly resulting in attorney fees, et cetera, as the licensees choose to go to hearing. That's point one. The other point, and that I don't know is incredibly visible to the Oregon Association of Realtors, who aren't typically at those proceedings. Their involvement is a step removed, so I would just point that out. The other thing that I want to talk about, Mr. Farmer indicated that there's no provision in the change from the former statutory language to the new language proposed. And I believe he's correct with an important exception. In this change, where we would lose negligence as a charge and move to gross negligence, we don't want to overlook the other licensees that our agency addresses, and that is property managers, rental properties. This is an area where I don't believe there's a substitution for this loss of the negligence term, and that I don't think is something that is as visible to them as they represent their real estate licensees. We are often presented with complaints from property owners that the property manager failed to represent them in the management of the property. Our administrative rules and our statutes address very clearly what's required on a trust account, accounting report sort of basis of that nature. But occasionally we get a request to investigate a dispute about something that's not dictated within the property management agreement or within a standard agreement. Such an example might be the property has been allowed to drop into disrepair. The property manager has not kept the level of occupancy appropriate. It's not difficult for me to imagine. I know the day is around the corner when someone tells us that they just found out the property they own has been used as a meth lab. The property manager didn't take care of that, wasn't aware of it, never brought it to their attention. And we will be compelled at that point to try to prove the property manager was grossly negligent in not addressing the property's needs and the owner's concerns. That, I believe, is a whole. And I just wanted to bring that to your attention again. It's described in my oral testimony and in the written submission from last Friday. Finally, I want to stress that I'm not sure that this change from a negligence standard to gross negligence sends an appropriate message to the licensee community. As people come before our I do the settlement conferences, and as they come before our forum, and I often encourage them to slow down. They move very, very quickly in doing their work, and they miss details. It's an extraordinarily detailed sort of work. And I just think that telling them now that a law has passed that moves the standard to gross negligence from negligence sends the wrong message to the community. It's an extraordinarily detailed business. The amount of knowledge and the different areas that a real estate licensee needs to cover, as well as a property manager, are varied. They are complex. They are far-reaching. And a misstep can cost the public a huge amount of money. And we see this happen, thus we get complaints. So I don't want that lost. The other area of the bill, if I could turn your attention to page 6, again in section 3, it's subsection 4, and that is the change concerning the advertising violations, requiring the agency to now prove knowingly or reckless behavior to get to a violation. I am here to concede that this wasn't on our radar screen when we made the previous concessions, but we have now looked the bill over. We are concerned that it again changes the level of care. I don't want to send a message to the community that moving quickly and your advertising's okay if it is misleading, as long as you didn't do it knowingly or recklessly. Wrong standard to send. It seems the time that we're lowering the level of care needed to assure protection of the public. So with that, I believe I will hand off to Ms. Shute. If there are particular questions at this time, I'm happy to field them. And again, I would encourage you to look through my written submission from last Friday that enumerates point by point where we did come to compromise and today's testimony where we don't.
Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Ms. Shute to testify on any questions, and we're going to have some legislative response on that, and that's how we're going to kind of proceed so people in the audience know. Go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Christine Shute. I'm an attorney in charge of the Business Activities Section, Oregon Department of Justice. The reason I'm here today on behalf of the Department of Justice is that my section represents almost all of the state's professional licensing agencies, everything from the Board of Medical Examiners to the Real Estate Agency to the board that regulates tattoo artists and body piercers. So I have a broad experience, and the lawyers in my section also have a broad experience with professional licensing and, I guess, quasi-professional. The Department of Justice's concerns line up very well with those that Ms. Osborne just described on behalf of the real estate agency, and they center around Section 3, Subsections 4 and 12. Subsection 4 is the section that relates to the advertising provisions and now would permit the real estate agency to discipline only upon a showing that the misleading advertising or false advertising was either knowingly or recklessly provided by the real estate professional. And the Department of Justice has concerns that that standard is not a standard that one would normally think of holding a professional to. Normally one would hold a professional responsible for the content of the advertising regardless of whether they had intentionally misled the person. In other words, the professional is responsible to make sure that the advertising is not misleading and not false, as opposed to it's okay so long as they didn't do it intentionally. The second concern that we have is subsection 12, and that's the provision that Ms. Osborne has talked about that changes the standard from negligence to gross negligence. And you'll see in my written testimony some discussion of what specifically the gross negligence standard is, and I want to take a moment just to direct your attention to that. Oregon's courts have defined gross negligence, which is the standard contended for here by the professional association, as conscious indifference to or reckless disregard of the rights of others. It involves indifference to the probable consequences of one's actions and, in the court's words, an I don't care what happens attitude. That permitting discipline based on gross negligence as opposed to negligence, that would be a very unusual standard to hold a professionally licensed person to. And I submit to you that could result in either, at best, a lot of litigation about what the precise parameters of gross negligence were in any given set of circumstances, or at worst, it could result in significantly less protection for American consumers as the real estate agency attempts to shepherd realtors toward better conduct as opposed to worse conduct. Now, the proponents of this bill have testified that there is no conduct that is currently disciplinable, if that's a word, that would not remain disciplinable under this statute, under this proposed change, and I'm not exactly sure that that's correct. And the reason I say that is that courts tend to look at changes in legislative language as meaningful. They don't look at changes in legislative language as merely an exercise in editing. So if the real estate agency were to attempt to bring some claim against someone, for example, for false advertising, it is my guess, well, not my guess, my considered belief that the courts would look to this limitation on advertising and say that is the parameter of your authority, real estate agency, to discipline someone based on false or misleading advertising. Even if you adopt rules that are more stringent, the statute will control. I have the same concerns about moving from a negligence standard to a gross negligence standard.
Ms. Shute, if I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to kind of get to some of the issues here. I think you've given us a pretty good overview. We understand where you're coming from.
Okay.
Could you tell me what the negligence standard is? You've explained gross negligence. So in the legalese, what is negligence? What is that standard?
Mr. Chairman, negligence means that there is a standard of care and that you have violated the standard of care. Your conduct has somehow fallen below that standard. Normally, for torts, if we're down in the circuit court in Marion County suing each other over whether one of us was negligent or not, it will require us to show damages. This discipline statute doesn't require a showing of any specific damage. It merely requires a showing that damage is possible or probable.
Okay.
Harm, damage meaning harm.
Okay. Questions from the committee in this panel? Senator Scar.
What's the standard for architects in ORS 671090 sub 4, do you know?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Starr, I honestly have to say I don't have that statute memorized, but I did take a look at it a couple of days ago, and my recollection is that there is a gross negligence standard in the architect statute, but there's also a provision in one of the other subsections, if memory serves, that says that violation of any professional standard is also a basis for discipline, and my understanding of it is that violation of a standard is the negligence standard. So, in other words, I know that there is a reference to the gross negligence standard, but I believe there's another wraparound provision that sucks in all of the other professional standards that sounds a lot like a negligence standard to me. I'd want to, but I will check that and get back to you on that to make sure I'm absolutely correct on that.
And would your answer be the same for the tax consultants that also has a gross negligence standard, that they have some broader standard besides gross negligence in their...
Senator Metzger, Senator Starr, that's my understanding. From that, and I, as I said, I took a quick walk through some of these a couple of days ago to check. I didn't find anyone that was just a gross negligence standard.
That would be helpful information. Thank you.
Yes, I'll get back to you on that.
Other questions?
Yes.
Senator Decker, then Senator Atkinson.
Go, I want to be real deferential to Senator Atkinson and let him go first.
You're so kind. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. I have just a couple questions. They're not all that connected, but, you know, when we have really big issues, often we hear from the head agencies. When I have a problem with DEQ, I am on the phone, and Stephanie's here. When I have an issue with OWEB or an issue with ODF&W or any of the agencies we have, the head of the agency come here, especially when an agency has changed their mind mid-course. Where's the head of your agency?
Chairman Metzger and Senator Atkinson, Commissioner Taylor is unable to be here today, and he sends his regrets. I can explain that he is the immediate past president of an international organization of real estate regulators. The acronym is ARELO, and it stands for Association of Real Estate License Law Organization. He's attending a meeting that is out of the country as a member of their board, and that meeting was scheduled, I'm afraid, not only before the bill dropped, but also before he could have even predicted that the bill existed. and he battled seriously with whether or not he should attend this out-of-the-country meeting, considering that the legislation was pending. But inasmuch as this hearing hadn't been scheduled and he didn't know when it would be, he went ahead and attended the meeting, unable to predict when this might happen. He's due back in the country tomorrow, back to the agency Thursday, and I know he'll regret that he missed this hearing. If there's any particular message to extend or retrieve from him, I'd be happy to cover that to the best of my ability.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I have a couple more. Has the agency recruited anyone to be here to speak against the bill?
Chairman Metzger and Senator Atkinson, I would be the one as the regulation manager to step in next, or our deputy commissioner. And Commissioner Taylor thought if this was a possibility, he asked that I attend.
Can I read from the transcript, Mr. Chair? This is what's got me bothered. This is from the transcript, March 30th, 05, the work session on the bill. Quoting you.
Yes.
Thank you, Chairman Brown and members of the committee. I'm Becky Osborne. I'm the Regulation Division Manager for the agency. Mr. Farmer is correct that the language that we had agreed on and shared, I don't think there's any surprise to the agency about that, so I don't believe we have any difficulty with it. Is a deal or is it not?
And Chairman Metzger and Senator Atkinson, can I explain that that particularly concerned language that was replaced into Section 5 that had been omitted by legislative council.
And that's one that you did the conceptual amendment on.
So
yes, that was an amendment proposed by the agency.
Then why didn't you object on the bill?
And Chairman Metzger and Senator Atkinson, I can tell you that I was speaking to the specific question, and if that was my opportunity to lay out again the entire objection that the agency had to the bill, I failed and did not do so. And I was speaking only in that limited function related to that portion. The question, I think, that came up subsequent was whether AFSCME was also on board with it, and I represented on their behalf because I had correspondence from their folks that, again, subject to that very limited provision, they were.
One more question.
Yes, Senator.
Now, what you just said, you reread the bill and came up with another objection. What was that again? I didn't get a chance to write that down.
Chairman Metzger and Senator Atkinson, that related to the Section 3, Subsection 4 portion related to advertising. That had not been on our radar screen, the change to knowingly or recklessly advertising. And I wanted to bring that forward. I understand that that was not noted before.
Mr. Chair, one more question. How long have you had the bill in your office?
I'm going to, Senator Atkinson, let me check with Mr. DeMarco, but I believe it was first arrived in our office immediately after it was dropped. It had not been discussed and negotiated prior to that time, as is the normal course. So I'm thinking
February 21.
Mr. DeMarco tells me February 21 was the day we first saw the verbiage.
And now you have no objections. I'm sorry. It's not a personal attack, but I mean, for crying out loud, get on with it. I mean, all my colleagues here, we're responsible to watch 4,000 bills. Sometimes we miss things. We have one person staffs. That's it. We don't have an entire agency. But every one of my colleagues here that I've worked with will say when we shake hands and we've got a deal, we've got a deal. And I've worked with every member of this committee and multiple members on both sides of the aisle. When we say deal, deal means deal. That doesn't mean deal on the House and we go work behind each other's back on the House on the Senate side and we go over the House and start having new objections. It's a process. This has got me bugged.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes-Anderson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to side with realtors. I don't want to side with the agency. I'm looking at this as a consumer protection bill. And the things that you addressed, or the three things that you have addressed, to me, going from negligence to gross negligence, I think in the best interest of the consumer should stay at negligence. The other area regarding your that verbiage that you were concerned about, I again take a look at that as a consumer protection issue and wouldn't have a problem in having a
amendment as you had proposed on page 3 of 3 on this one to solve that one. And the other issue that you haven't brought up is the disputed earnest money, and where the verbiage in section 2, where the seller would be in practical terms prevented from receiving their earnest money back, the buyer would be able to, but not the seller. Again, I would think that should be changed too. So I'm just looking at this committee as a consumer protection issue, and would hope that these would seem very minor, because I agree with the Real Estate Association that you need to sort of streamline and get rid of all of this verbiage that was in statute. But along these three issues, I feel that it's in the best interest of the consumer, not of the agency or the realtor, that some slight changes need to be made. And yes, I think that the agency should have picked this up before. That's their problem. We have the problem of sending out a bill that is actually going to be in the best interest of consumers. So that's my point of view on it.
Thank you, Senator. I'm going to be moving along here. Just, I want to be clear, because what I have actually heard is that this dispute of what you agreed to was in Section 5, was not the issue in Section 4, that you say you did miss the knowingly or recklessly, but you had previously brought up the issue of gross negligence in the discussion of the bill in committee. And the discussion we're talking about, you know, did not, was in, relate to a specific question in another section, Section 5.
Chairman, that's,
okay.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to, we're going to move ahead a little bit. I'll have you step back. I'm going to have our legislative House members come forward. Hold on a second, Senator. Do you have a question for this group?
Well, no.
No, go ahead, Senator. I'm sorry. If you have a question
for this
group.
I was just trying to be friendly to my Senator Atkinson. Well, I can speak with y'all offline, but to me, I'm a little slow, but I didn't get where the gross negligence and the misleading advertising, to me, I'm trying to think through in my head, how is this going to be problematic for the consumer? And so I just need some help. If y'all feel strongly, I wasn't convinced by your testimony, but I would need to meet with you again to understand how that is going to be problematic for the consumer, because I just couldn't pick it up.
Okay, Senator Deckert, we'd be happy to give you some supplemental information.
Great. And Mr. Chair, I have three people working on my staff.
Three?
Just for the record. Yes.
Right. He must have a lot of money. I do want to watch just one question with one response from one person. And that would be, I'm just testing this on that one issue of gross negligence. What would your view, if that did read, demonstrated gross negligence, repeated negligence, incompetence, or untrustworthiness? So you'd have a gross negligence standard, but if you had somebody that was maybe not gross negligence, but they had more than a couple instances of negligence, that also would fall under that bailiwick. Which one of you would like to react to that?
I guess that people are looking at me, Senator Metzger, so I'll respond to that. Gross negligence coupled with repeated negligence is surely better than gross negligence standing alone.
Okay.
From the consumer's perspective, I would say.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, I would ask our members of the House of Representatives on the committee are here, and I appreciate their patience, but I wanted to, before we get the he said thing, have a chance for them to hear and come forward. And then what we're going to do, because of the length of this agenda, I'm not going to be able to move this bill. So we're going to move to House Bill or Senate Bill 671. Welcome.
Senator, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Derek Kitt, State Representative from Hillsborough, House District 30. Sal, you want to state your name?
Yes, I'm Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, which is Medford.
I just wanted to come here on behalf of the work group that was established, that we put in a lot of time on this. The objections that are being brought up now are not really a surprise. They were issues that were discussed. I will tell you that we set up the work group and we set the bill out, and I went down to the agency and I said, let's walk through it section by section. Tell me where all your problems are. They outlined all their problems. I said to the other side, I said, what's your response to that? Can we get there? Line by line, item by item, there was compromise reached. Now, there were two sticking points. The negligence versus the gross negligence was an issue. But what was said to me by the commissioner, I wish that he were here, was said to me is, I'm not going to fall on my sword for this. It's not that big a deal. Would I like it the other way? Yeah, probably. But let's get on with it. Which is why I came out of committee 7-0. It was two work groups. It was that simple. We outlined it. And then this is the, as a result of people working against the bill now, this is the first that I've heard of it. So it kind of comes as a shock because I did think that we had agreement. So I just wanted to be here as the guy that headed up the work group. If you guys had any questions, you senators had any questions for me, I was more than happy to answer them. But I think it's a good bill.
Thank you. Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair, senators. I come here twofold. One is not only a member of the committee that heard this bill, but I am one of the few realtors in this building with an active real estate license. I've been a broker and an agent for about 14 years. Let me show you some things that we have in this industry and what we're trying to achieve with this bill. I'm going to outline the bill first, and then I'm going to talk about some other issues as well, with your indulgence. This is a seven-part real estate agreement, seven pages. What is happening is everyone is not educated because we have not had the proper education from this agency, so therefore everyone's covering their rear-end skis. And here is a sample, believe it or not, of an addendum to this same seven-page agreement. This is initiated in order to protect one from possible litigation because of the inability of the agency, in my opinion, to educate its members properly. We have three people in that education department over there, and you never see them. That's a fact. I never see them. Here's a response from the other agent to take care of these disclosures that were initiated by the unclarity of what we're supposed to do as realtors. What we're trying to do here with 2604 is to streamline this so everyone knows what they're doing. The thing that bothers me here the most, I think, is the fact that if I were the head of an agency and I had a hearing on a bill that I objected to and that I did not have a budget, I would be in this building. Let's talk about this advertising thing. Right now, the way it's worded, if I put in an advertisement in the paper and they left something out, guess who's liable? Me. That's the way it's worded right now. Let's talk about gross negligence and negligence. Gross negligence, I'm going to give you an example of it. We had an individual in Southern Oregon that forged a document in a contract. The individual that turned that individual in, which they should have done, they investigated it. The guilty person had a six-month suspension of license. Now, in my opinion, that individual should never have practiced real estate in the state of Oregon. But what really bothered me, it comes under this negligence part. The individual that turned them in missed a date on this seven-page earnest money agreement, even though that had been faxed with a time and a date on it, and they had a letter of reprimand. That's why we have to distinguish between negligence and gross negligence. It's varying degrees. We need to spell this out because obviously if you have a blanket of negligence, that can encompass anything. So that's why that part is in this. You're going to hear from the agency themselves that are going to object to this, and I imagine maybe the unions. The unions, in my opinion, represent the employees to make sure we have a good place for those employees and a good working atmosphere, and that's what we're striving to do. But more importantly, they carry out the policy that we craft. We make policy. This is just scratching the surface. This bill is a cause and effect. We have deeper problems and concerns, and we need to look into them as a legislator, as a body. So, having said that, I will now close, and hopefully that we will pass this out of this committee. And there are some concerns about advertising, gross negligence, and negligence, but I hope I've outlined those for clarity for your indulgence to make a decision. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Representative. Questions for our guests? Thank you for taking the time. Yes, so Senator Atkins.
Both of you agreed that you had a deal with the agency, and the agency came over the Senate and changed the deal, correct?
There's no doubt in my mind, Senator.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. What I'm going to do, I know there's other people set to sign up on this bill, and what I'm going to do is I have one person who has signed up, Ms. Jarvis, who's 100 miles away. I have 5 minutes because I'm not, you know, I want to be fair to all the people who I have scheduled today. So, and that is, well, you tell me. Yes, Art Kyler or Kylan. Yeah. Members, I think we're getting an issue. We've got a few narrow issues here. We're gonna have to chew on these things and get some more issues on it before we do this.
Thank you very much. I'm Art Kegler, practicing realtor, also chair of the Government Affairs Cog that handles the legislation for OAR. With a dual hat, I should get to the other mic now. I also am on the board appointed by the governor of the agency. And secondly, I've just been elected to president-elect and president of OAR for president-elect 06 and president 07. So I'm involved, if you will, on both sides. The bill, the process, was explained by Cynthia, our current president, that it has gone through a process for over a year. I'm on the agency board, attend all the meetings, and not once did anybody from the agency ask me anything about it. There was a white paper on it a year ago on this same issue that was presented. It went through all of the process, and what it came down to is what we tried to present to make it a more functional industry without, and with due respect, without taking anything away from the consumer. Biggest issue that's on this floor comes down to me as a layperson, not an attorney. When we talk about negligence and gross negligence, we talk about intent and incidental. The missing of the date was incidental. The forgery or the changing of a document was actually intent. I cannot write, and I review for my agents. I have multiple offices. I review for my agents their advertising. It is with definite intent that we create advertising. You can't not write advertising incidentally. You have to write it with intent on what you're trying to accomplish to advertise that property. So when I look at that one issue on advertising, I don't think gross negligence or negligence is really a factor, because you have to, with intent, write advertising. I won't go on that one. The other issue that I want to make clear is that the agency was aware of our process, was aware of how we evolve a bill. It goes through the committee that I chair, or we call them a COG, Key Objective Group. It goes through that process. We're available. We're public. We do not close those meetings. And it ultimately goes to the board of directors of Oregon Association of Realtors before it becomes a bill. I will remind you that the commissioner is a member of the board of directors and gets the minutes and all of the issues on the agenda and what we take as our legislative policy. I don't want to drone on. I will stop there. If there are any questions I can answer, I'd be happy to try to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Kegler. Thank you for your patience. Questions for Mr. Kegler? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close public hearing on House Bill 2644A and where we are with this. I need some more information in discussing with some of the parties some of the issues today. I appreciate the discussion about what was or was not part of the committee hearing. But as Senator Juana Sanderson also pointed out, our objective is to make sure that we send out, you know, the legislation that does what we think is in the best interest of the industry and the people who utilize it. So we will talk about that. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 671. Appreciate your patience, Mr. Barrows. If you want to bring your threesome up, I would appreciate that. Welcome again.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the privilege of appearing again before you. It's been several weeks. For the record, my name is John Stogeberg. I'm representing Oregon Mutual Utility Development on behalf of Senate Bill 671. A little background on me. I don't think I appropriately introduced myself last time. I have 20 years of experience working for Pacific Corp. Was involved and responsible for nearly $10 billion of financing, both domestically and internationally. And also have regulatory experience in the areas of cost of capital and regulation. I believe you've received a copy of the responses that Chairman Metzger had requested at the last proceeding, dated April 25th, to the Senate Business and Economic Development Committee. I'll be brief, kind of covering some highlights that would like to identify for you on our behalf. What we see Senate Bill 671 providing is granting the authority to the Oregon Public Utility Commission, another tool in their toolbox for regulating utilities and approving this fixed acquisition charge and the financing. It also provides opportunity to save customers up to $100 million a year of savings. And it also provides another alternative to present before Enron in order to acquire Portland General from Enron. OMU, or I shouldn't use acronyms, Oregon Mutual continues to be supportive of our process that provides alternatives. We applaud the actions of the committee in support of 1008 and the leadership that brought it forward. The legislation we're requesting is not new. It's not revolutionary. It's actually becoming quite common. Six states have adopted it for deregulation. Puget Sound Energy has had it implemented in the state of Washington for deferred power costs. In the process, Florida and Georgia are considering this form of legislation for hurricane damage recovery. Wisconsin, for pollution control recovery. And actually, Portland General Electric has legislation that was passed in 1997 for conservation investments that is essentially the same structure. $30 billion of these bonds have been issued, and they're amongst the lowest cost source of financing that a corporate borrower can obtain. It'll have no effect on PGE's credit ratings or its balance sheet. There's no guarantee by the state or bonding capacity of any municipality or locality. Provides customers opportunity to acquire the equity of Portland General Electric at the lowest cost. Profits will be retained locally. We will pay state taxes, franchise fees, property taxes, except for federal income taxes. Mr. Pendergraft, who is here, has a letter in the package that describes that process. It ensures local control, stable prices, and a reliable power. We feel this is a simple solution. It's a private solution to acquire Portland General Electric for its customers. There will be an interim board of directors. And once the customers acquire the company at the first annual meeting, they will begin to elect new board members. It's a not-for-profit company. It's customer ownership, not Enron. has a long-term vision rather than short-term earnings performance. Otherwise, PGE remains the same. We listed quite a few areas where there's really no intent to change the management of PGE, nor its operations, nor its regulatory environment. Questions come, is OMU ready for this transaction? We have a fairly extensive milestone list. We have a financial model that's been completed. We've appointed a financial advisor. We have legal counsel in Perkins Coie and Thompson Hine. We've received a highly confident letter from our financial advisor that the financing will be there. We've appointed a board of directors, at least the initial four. We're on the process of getting an engagement with a major accounting firm. Public outreach has commenced. We've been in discussions with Enron, and we're in the process of finalizing our tax review. We hope the responses that we've provided in this address the questions, but we stand ready to answer any questions to clarify and would be pleased to. But thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, and I very much appreciate. I know all members received a copy as scheduled, and it was very, very helpful. One area that I'd asked that I still have a lack of clarity on, and I received another communication from Commissioner Beyer today, and this again is the assertion of the OPUC oversight and what the law allows them to do. And he continues to say, as of today, if I can just read from the memo, if the legislature chose to encourage creation of a mutual and wanted the commission to regulate its operation, changes in state law would be necessary, which would provide the commission with clear direction and authority. So they continue to say they don't have that. And that would be something that I think would have to be incorporated into the bill in order to fulfill some of those provisions that otherwise, I think are covered in some of the language you have written. Is there a response from...
Yes, we met with the representatives of the Oregon Public Utility Commission this morning, and that question and issue came up. And I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Gold here to respond to that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Ivan Gold. I'm an attorney with Perkins Coie. I represent Oregon Mutual Utility Development, Inc. As background, my entire career has been spent with transactions involving the electric utility industry. I was a lawyer for Pacific Power and Light Company. I was a deputy public utility commissioner of the state when we only had one commissioner. I've lobbied for the state on energy matters in Congress, served for deregulation at the Civil Aeronautics Board, represented a number of industrial customers of utilities, and from about 1990 through 2003, I was developing projects nationally and internationally with regard to renewable energy and other generation sources. The question was raised by the PUC whether they would regulate Portland General Electric Acquisition Company as a mutual corporation. In our opinion, they would, because the utility has an obligation to serve all persons who come to it within its service territory requesting service, which we believe is the definition of a public utility under ORS 757005. There are a number of exemptions under ORS 757005. We don't happen to think that we would fall within one. However, we think it should be clearly expressed that it is our intent that the utility be regulated by the PUC in all respects as it is today. We would much prefer to make any changes needed on the House side. If someone would want to clarify that point, it is clearly within our intention that the PGE be regulated by the PUC.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker.
Thank you. Just a question just on that, because I can't imagine... and again, I should say, I appreciate how much hard work I know a little bit about it, that y'all have put into this. I don't understand how the PUC could regulate this entity. And, I've been trying to wrestle with this and spoke to one of your representatives briefly about this a couple days ago. So you have this, you have a mutual. The PUC's job is to stand in between an investor-owned utility and the customers. And there's that natural tension between shareholders' interest, maximizing returns, and customers trying to keep rates down as low as they can. So, I mean, as it stands today, PGE makes a bad decision, or PacifiCorp or whomever, and the PUC comes in and they say, imprudent decision has been made. This is not going to fall on the customers. This is going to the investors. Now, this mutual, how would they regulate? Okay, imprudent decisions have been made, and they're made all the time. I mean, that's actually the role of the PUC is to do that. Who would they go after under the mutual when imprudent decisions, because it's just natural, are going to be made? And who would they ultimately pick up the price tag on that?
Senator Metzger, Senator Deckert, that's an excellent question, and one that has arisen and we have discussed. Nothing would change from the situation today. What the PUC regulates are the revenues that are permitted to be recovered in the rates of the utility. And if the PUC determines that an expense is imprudent, they do not permit the utility to recover that expense in its rates. And they speak really to the management of the utility in saying that the rates they seek will not be allowed, they'll be reduced, or they won't be as high. In one case, in the case of today with Portland General Electric, you see that the shareholders see a reduction in the value of their company. They see a reduction in their dividend. They see a reduction in the value of their capital, of their retained earnings. Now imagine a situation in which the investors are also the customers of the utility. And imagine a situation in which management has been wasting money. The exact same thing happens. Either the customers do not see the same level of refunds that they're accustomed to, or when they're advised what ownership they have in the company and how much it's worth, they see that their management's imprudent decisions have reduced the value of their ownership interest in the company. And once again, the same tension exists, because the management has done something wrong, and the people that have been damaged by it, the investors, who in this case also are the ratepayers, have every right, opportunity, and should be expected to exercise control over those executives so that the same issues don't happen again, just as the investors would today.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, Mr. Chair, to me, I mean, I wouldn't even pretend to have PUC oversight in that respect. I mean, it's just like any other public entity. Because the PUC has no recourse other than to just say, customers, you put the bill. Customers, you pick up, which is any other public entity, because there is no investor involved. And so, to me, I mean, and I think that's one of the issues. I don't know if we're going to have the PUC up, but to me, that's just a legitimate issue.
I've represented utilities. I've been a regulator, and I have represented the customers of utilities. And it is the customer that always ends up paying the price for bad management. When the rates are reduced and the investors suffer, the cost of capital goes up and the customers have to pay more. I agree that it seems incongruous to say that the ratepayers are going to be responsible if the executives do a bad job and the PUC controls that, but the customers are responsible for everything in any event, unfortunately. I would also say that the PUC has many other jobs with regard to regulation. They regulate the issuance of securities. They regulate how the rates are spread between customer classes. I think that this particular commission has over the years really done groundbreaking work in making certain that one customer class doesn't get an advantage over another customer class. I am in favor of all the options that have been kept open, but I will say that our option is the only option that maintains the continuity of PUC regulation of rate differentials among customer classes attributed to cost.
I have other questions, but I don't know if now is the time to just...
Please, go ahead. We'll see.
Just on that point, just to me, I mean, the PUC correctly assesses, and we can have them up, correctly assesses that this entity would be a real problem of how you, because central to their mission, I think you might agree with me on that, central to their mission is to stand between that tension, between that natural tension between investors and customers. I guess the two other quick questions I have on the mutual, and I came in late, so I hope I'm not interrupting a flow of testimony. One is just on the tax status. I mean, there's certain advantages that you would have on acquisition, and one is on tax status. And I guess it'd be helpful for me to see an IRS letter or some documentation before we vote that determines what the tax status of this entity would be.
I'm going to ask the accountant, J.T. Davenport, to respond to that. Senator
Davenport, please.
My name is J.T. Pendergraf.
That's all right.
Chairman.
Davenport.
It's all one family, right? I'm a CPA. I've been with Pacific Corp, and I've been a number of advising other companies, startup companies, on this. Right now, we're looking to do a letter ruling, but it would take a letter ruling, and a letter ruling through the IRS takes a matter of months. It would be probably in September, I'm told right now, to get a letter from the IRS stating exactly what they would tax, whether they would tax us or not. What I've done is a number of quite a bit of research, and in my research I found that for tax purposes you can be a co-op without being actually a co-op. It requires that a couple of things happen. One, that you have good governance, that every customer has a vote, and that the excess, which they call patronage, is distributed in regards to the amount of usage of the commodity. So those two things are being met, and that would lead me to that under such section, subchapter K of the Internal Revenue Code, that the company would fall into that area. And basically that allows that it's not a tax-exempt company, but that as long as they pay out to the customers that margin, then that margin is reduction in the amount of taxable income the company is subject to. So if you pay out 100% of the margin, then you have a zero balance to be paid taxes on. So that's how they become a non-profit company, because they're paying out, they stay at a level of zero.
So just on that, Mr. Chair, I've heard differing points of view on that question, and to me, I mean, it would be difficult, and I'm just solely speaking for myself, but this is such a gravitous decision without having some sort of confirmation, because that is millions of ratepayer dollars are in the balance there, maybe the B word, billions of ratepayer dollars, probably millions, I'll give you that, of ratepayer dollars are hanging in the balance of that. And so to me, we would just need some, because obviously once we cast our votes, we've allowed someone to talk to the trustees with ratepayer dollars, because we're all bargaining with ratepayer dollars. And so to me, it's just, I would need a lot of clarity on the tax status of this entity before, and I'm just speaking for myself, before I could say yes, and we want those folks talking to the trustees of Enron.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you being here today. My understanding is that the Oregon Mutual Utility Development Inc. Can go forward, move ahead with a planned acquisition of PGE, regardless of whether the legislature passed the amendments that are proposed for Senate Bill 671. But all this does is provide you the opportunity to basically to have cheaper money. Is that the real deal? Would your company proceed if the legislature didn't pass this bill and provide this opportunity for cheaper money for your company?
Thank you, Senator Starr, for that question. Good question. The question is, or the answer to that is that that's correct. This provides the lowest cost financing we could obtain in order to acquire Portland General for its customers. Yes, we could find other means to finance the acquisition. The question is, at the end of the day, based upon the price we would offer to Enron and based upon the cost of the financing and based upon the earnings capability of Portland General to return to its customers, can we show a net benefit to the OPUC in order for them to approve the acquisition? That will be the test, whether or not we would proceed beyond this. But this structure provides the greatest amount of benefit for customers for this acquisition. It doesn't cost the state anything. There's no guarantees, no bonding capacity used by the state. It's all private sector money that is being used here.
Just to follow up,
yes.
About how much ratepayer dollars would be saved if the legislature were to pass this bill? You have this opportunity for this cheaper money in the event that you're able to fulfill some deal.
I'm not sure I fully understood the question.
What's that? How much would you say? Another answer is triple credit.
Oh. Doing the math in my head right now. I figure that, let's just take an example, for a 20-year maturity, which would have about a 13-year average life, recent pricing for that is around 5%. If we were to do this on PGE's credit, which is triple B, that would probably cost at least another 100 basis points. So that, if we assume $1 billion of debt, that's $100 million.
Okay.
And but the other issue too is if we do it on PGE's credit, we could trash PGE's credit. It would be non-investment grade because it suddenly have $1 billion of debt sitting on its balance sheet. And so the cost of that would be tremendous, and we wouldn't proceed.
Any questions? Senator Morris Anderson?
Explain to me a little bit about tariffs. When I think of tariff, that means the ratepayers are going to be paying, I think I had the information, $5 or $6 a month. And most people don't like seeing different tariffs or fees or whatever on their bills. Explain how that works. And then under the ownership, who has direction of that revenue or that money?
I think you're referring on the $5 to the example we put in this response. That would be essentially the principal and interest on the debt that is being repaid on a monthly or annual or semi-annual basis. In return, the customers have immediately 100% access to the earnings and profits of Portland General. If you take 2004 as an example, where we have some actual numbers, we're not using forecasts or assumptions and all that. My recollection is that Portland General had a $93 million profit. It also had about $50 million of federal income taxes that it paid on for retail revenues. The total of that equals, $143 million. If you divide that by the usage, that works out to, on an average customer, which for $100 monthly average bill of $100, about $11 in benefit. And so the net would be an actual reduction to the customer's cost than they would have had otherwise. And this is taking out any equations for higher gas prices or low hydro conditions or other things that occur. Again, this would be part of the And I agree with you. You see another charge, it's almost like a tax that you see placed on a bill, but we would have a benefit that would at least offset that, if not more. And that's what we would have to prove to the commission. Is that satisfactory?
Yeah, because there's a lot of questions around that issue, okay. And I just wanted to get that little piece anyway on the record.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to ask you to stand down in our last 10 minutes. I'm going to ask Mr. Wells from the PUC to come forward. Mr. Bissonnette has signed up to come forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A question for the Public Utility Commission. We get a lot of different signals the last 4 weeks about different answers to different questions depending on who we have from OPUC or WEGA. So that's kind of troubling to me because I on a number of issues. And I have Chairman Byers' letter from today to me regarding the issue of governance and oversight from your perspective. I want to know if you would validate that. Do we need that provisions in this bill to effect the testimony we've had and the intents of the proponents of having your oversight and rate setting, et cetera? Do we need that component added to this bill to make that happen?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Rick Willis with PUC. If I understand your question correctly, yes. Is the answer. We've looked at the bill, and there's a number of areas, and I think Senator Deckard raised them as well, where the laws as they're written today don't match up well with this configuration. They are made for investor-owned utilities. They are not written in such a way for a mutual. Could they be changed to meet that? I suspect so, but they're not written that way today. So the answer is yes. We believe that some amendments would need to be made so that we could properly regulate this company.
Mr. Bissonnette.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. I come before you today just to offer some reflections on the Oregon Mutual Utility concept, and we have spent a fair amount of time kind of trying to divine what the proponents of this concept have in mind. We actually submitted to them a list of 34 questions, getting at the details. I think all of you have a list of those questions as well. If you don't, I'd be happy to provide them. And we sent that to them on the 13th of April, and I was actually in the back of the room reading the material that was passed out to you today, some of which we've seen before in terms of the governor's task force responses. But I can't say, sitting here, that I know a lot more than I did before opening up that packet. We have a proposal that is at one time said this is very unique and innovative and uniquely Oregon. That's a paraphrase of a line here, but then we also have testimony that says this is something that's used for a wide variety of purposes, and actually that's one of the things that does concern us, is that unlike other proposals, for instance, Senate Bill 1008, that is self-contained, and you can agree with it or not, but if the bill passes and nothing happens, that's it. With the proposals here, there are changes that are being made to the PUC authority, and then, if the Oregon Mutual Utility effort does not actually happen, we've changed state law, and the authority can be used for other purposes, and that that concerns us.
Could you tell me what you mean by other purposes?
because the way I read this, it applies to it only to an issuing utility, which is defined specifically as Portland General Electric. So what could you help me on where your train of thought is going there, on what
we
other purpose?
We have some concerns, and again, this is from the dash four amendments that, and I'm not, and so if there's something else, I'm happy to look at those. But I know that our legal counsel had looked, for instance, at section 6, sub 1, that there's some constitutional problems here, and possibly going against the constitutional prohibition of binding future commissions, as an example. And that was actually shared with them on our question 32. There are others I'd have to go through to look at those. But there's essentially we're concerned that this is not as self-contained an effort, to go a lot into the legal definitions, I'd have to bring my counsel down, and I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Well, one thing I would say is that, and I appreciate that, and we had some questions, as you know, as well, from this committee, and asked the proponents to provide a synopsis of those responses, which they did. And it would be also helpful to have more clarity of what those issues are, you know, from you, not the questions, but what you say think the answers are out there that are not appropriate would be really helpful for us, what you think that means. Questions for these folks?
Just real briefly, and I'm not sure if it's for them or not, but where is the liability? I mean, there must be a huge liability here if something goes wrong. Who has that liability?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris-Anderson, it's my understanding that the entire ownership would go to the customers of PGE. Therefore, I believe, and I'm not a lawyer, but I believe that the liability responsibility would go there as well.
Just follow up?
Yeah.
If we went bankrupt, if PGE went bankrupt, what does that mean to the customers then? I doubt if they will, because they're an awesome utility.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris-Anderson, I presume you're talking about if this agreement were consummated, it became a mutual utility. I'm not quite sure how they could go bankrupt. It's my understanding that the way it's written, you have a securitized loan, that the rates would always be such that there would be sufficient money to pay back that loan. So I'm not real sure, unless they lost all their customers, how they would go bankrupt.
But then, follow up, then our rates would just go up, correct? I mean, in that sense, if for some reason their needs weren't being met for one reason or another, then the option will be just to increase our rates.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris-Anderson, that's my understanding. That's right, that all the revenue to pay back the loan or whatever capital they needed to operate the business would come out of rates, correct? That's my understanding.
Thank you. As you see, we have the other committees about 2 minutes away from 3 o'clock, so we're going to, this time, one thing I would ask proponents to do, is, and I know everybody's working under short time order, and that's part of the issue here, is to work diligently on including language that actually provides the governance structure for the OPUC to do what this says. I think that's a stress point. So thank you very much, gentlemen. I see PGE's in the back of the room. Does PGE have a position on this, by the way? Do you want to have a position on this? Okay. Okay. And I will have Teresa, even though I made scribbles on this, make copies for the members on Commissioner Byers' letter. By the way, I asked him to do some research. I did find it was rather interesting, just to point out as we close here, in terms of we've had a lot about public versus private utilities, and noted that in Washington, the three private utilities have lower rates than most of the consumer-owned utilities, including Seattle City Light and Tacoma Power. So it's not necessarily a foregone conclusion that we're going to have a lot lower rates on any of these. We're adjourned.